Welcome to the Veritas Podcast. For even more exciting content, visit our website at www.veritaswbc.com. Enjoy the podcast.
A little bit of a thing to talk about tonight. And the thing is this happens on a number of levels. This affects people on a number of levels. On one level, it's obviously personal. As a decision is made, it affects an individual with the decision that is made, knowing that the decision goes on forever. It's not like it's the kind of decision that you can take back. Once it's done, it's done. It involves, when you think about it, families. Families get tied up into decisions like this. Here's what I want to talk about as we look into the abortion issue tonight. I want us to focus on, if you cast ahead, I'm actually going to have a time where we look at the Roe v. Wade decision. That's not something that we're going to do tonight, but I think it's important that we do that. What was happening in 1973 when that decision went down? There was also another decision in 1973 that happened roughly at the same time as Roe v. Wade that happened in Georgia. We want to kind of put all of those topics on the table, and I've invited a speaker to come in that night, and that's what we're going to do. When we have that night, we're just going to interact. They're going to speak for a while on the legal side of things. Tonight, really what I want to do is I want to focus more on the ethical and the moral side of things. What I want us to look at is, what are some of the main arguments that you see out there that would ground, quote, a woman's right to choose? And are there good ways to respond to some of those things that are brought up regarding a woman's right to choose? That's what I want us to look at. But I also think it's good that we get a little bit of information as well. Because when you think about it, we're talking about, with abortion, 1.3 million lives each year. You know, 1.3 million lives each year. There's also something else to keep in mind, and I want to be very careful about this, but if just one family in every three churches in the United States adopted a waiting child, every waiting child in the United States would be adopted. All right, so let me repeat that for you. If just one family in every three churches in the United States adopted a waiting child, every waiting child in the United States would be adopted. Now, I'm putting that out there on the front end for a reason. And I want to exercise a little bit of caution here. Because the morality of abortion does not hinge on whether or not there's a waiting line to adopt a child. So let me just say that on the front end. You got to be careful with that. Because if what you're saying is, hey, look at all of these people that are waiting to adopt a child, and so this makes it unnecessary. If the line goes away, well, then your argument goes away as well. The discussion on the morality of abortion needs to be centered on something else. Now, that being said, I do want to say, since there is a waiting line, it does provide an extra bit of information for us to process as to whether or not it's necessary for this to happen. So that's why I'm just saying it on the front end. When it comes to abortion, and specifically Planned Parenthood, this comprises 96% of the pregnancy services that they provide, 96 to 97%. So what are they about? This is why people say they're basically an abortion business. If you're looking at 96 to 97%, there's a reason to say it, right? If it was batting 30%, I would probably say, that's not necessarily the strongest point to make. But it's overwhelmingly the service that they provide. How about this? 52% of abortions occur in women that are under 25 years of age. 52%. The abortion ratio for unmarried women is 510 for every 1,000 live births. 510 for every 1,000 live births. 22% of all pregnancies right now are ending in abortion. 64% of women polled said that they felt pressured, by the way, to get an abortion, 64%. And an overwhelming majority of women polled said that they felt pressure to get an abortion. And more than that, around 80% indicated that if they had some support, if they knew that the guy that got them pregnant, if they knew that their family, think their mother and their father, something like that, if what they knew is that they had the support available to them so that they could rear the child. And a lot of times these decisions are financial. How am I going to feed this kid? How am I going to put diapers on this kid? How am I? Those questions kind of weigh, and they don't see that there's an answer for that because they don't have the support, either coming from the father or coming from the parents. They feel like they're in a place where there's almost no choice to make. I'm bringing the kid into a situation where I can't provide for the kid, so maybe the most loving thing for me to do is this. Now, why start there? I start there for an obvious reason. So for those that are what you would call pro-life, there's a whole lot more to being pro-life than just saying that people shouldn't be getting abortions. There's a whole lot more to it. In fact, if what you're going to say is this life in the womb is intrinsically valuable, it is an end in itself. This life in the womb is not a means to an end. Then what this means is that we need to be putting basically our feet to where our beliefs are, that where there are convictions, there are actions, and advocating for the life of that child is more than just taking a moral stand. Although you do need to take moral stands, please hear what I'm saying. But advocating for the life of the child is what it really, in a fully orbed way, means to be pro-life. That's why I was bringing up some of the studies that I was bringing up. By all means, tell people what the right thing to do is. By all means, help them do the right thing. Help them do the right thing. This is why I have partnered in the past with groups like the Human Coalition, is because that's exactly what they try to do. In fact, they try to go into areas where abortion is going to be much more prevalent, where women feel like they don't have any support whatsoever. And they take these mobile wagons into those neighborhoods. And as they get with the women, they're able to provide sonograms for them so that they can see the baby and make a more informed decision. Because here's the thing. You got about a 48-hour window after the crisis point before a decision is being made. You got about 48 hours. So how should we be thinking about this? And here's the first thing. You need to make sure that you identify what the real issue is. You need to make sure that you're identifying what the real issue is. The disagreement, let me be clear here. The disagreement is not usually on this moral principle. Is it wrong to take an innocent human being's life? Now, I know that sounds strange, right? But that's not actually where the disagreement is. Nobody that I know is actually wondering whether or not the life in the womb is biologically human. Nobody that I know, nobody that I've read. In all of the stuff that I've read in ethics, I can't find one that's saying, it's not biologically human. There's a dog in there. You know, nobody's saying anything like that. Everybody recognizes that once you have a conceptus, you have, in terms of what is it, it's a fully formed biological organism. It's there. Nobody's really wondering about that. What it is that people are debating is whether or not the life in the womb is a person. And there's a difference. So something is biologically human, but that doesn't make it a human person. So you could have somebody like a Peter Singer. Peter Singer is considered to be one of the most thought-provoking and controversial ethicists of the last 100 years. And Peter Singer, who will admit he doesn't exactly have a lot of patience for the Judeo-Christian view, but what Peter Singer would say is, you know, the life in the womb is not a person, even though it's biologically human. To be a person means that you have consciousness, that you have self-awareness, that you have the understanding of who you are, that you're able to make certain choices, even if it's on a primitive level. This is why Peter Singer would go on to argue that high-functioning apes are more valuable than the life in the womb, because the life in the womb doesn't have the capacity of, like, Coco, who was a famous ape, if you remember, that could speak somewhere up around 1,500 words, or, you know, could communicate somewhere around 1,500 words. Peter Singer saw that ape as of a higher value than the human life in the womb. And here's why, is because he wasn't looking at whether or not there was anything intrinsically valuable. Intrinsically valuable means it's just valuable in and of itself. He was looking at it, and still is, looking at it from a purely functional value. So life can be, so to speak, a means to an end. So not a human person, well, then the rights of persons don't actually apply to them. So we need to make sure, again, I'm just trying to be clear on the front end, where's the disagreement? And if what you say, and like Peter Singer is sitting, he's not sitting here tonight, but let's say Peter Singer is sitting here tonight, and you say something about a human being, he's like, it's not my thing. It's just, when does this human being become a human person? And that happens much later. By the way, if you read anything by Peter Singer, here's what that means. That means that he says, in order to be totally consistent, it's completely arbitrary to say that simply because the child has passed through the birth canal, that all of this sudden, it's functioning at a higher capacity or a higher rate. It's not. There's actually no functional difference in the womb than just born and outside of the womb. He said, so if I'm going to be consistent, that's him, not me. If I'm going to be consistent, then I need to be a proponent of infanticide. And so he is. So he is. He thinks he's being consistent. By the way, let me say this. I agree with him. He's being consistent. But at what point do you say consistency just isn't worth it? Or maybe take a harder look at some of the assumptions that you're making here. So that's an important thing. We got to remember where the disagreement really is. The main point of the argument is, when does a biologically human become a person? When does it become a person? I'll just let something out of the bag here on the front end, at least for me. I'll let you into my head, at least with regards with the way that I think about it. I think when we're asking that question, I think we're making a confusion here. I think the confusion is, there's a confusion between being a person and functioning as a person. I think that's different. Some of the examples that you might that you might see, when I'm asleep, I'm not exactly exhibiting consciousness the way that some of these people are talking about. In fact, I'm completely unaware of a lot of things. But it doesn't make me any less of a person, even though I'm not functioning in that time as a fully conscious person. You get the idea. But when it comes to this question, when do they become a person? Is it at conception? Or is it at some other point in the natural development of the child? So here's the thing, and this is to the point. The essence of the fetus, when you think about it, is unchanged during the pregnancy. And in fact, the essence of the fetus is unchanged even beyond birth. The main thing, by the way, that happens with birth is you changed locations. That's what happens with birth. But the essence of the fetus itself hasn't changed at all. The constant growth process and development continues from conception all the way to adulthood. And this is why some ethicists would say, you know, that what you have in the natural development of the child is just it in the state of perfecting its nature. But its nature just is what it is. That's why I was bringing up the point before. You know, nobody's wondering whether or not it's like a canine nature or a feline nature as to what's in the womb. We all know it's a human being in there. So here's some suggestions that have been made regarding personhood. Here's one. Personhood begins when there is sentience. Here's the idea behind sentience. It's when the life in the womb, in this case, or any life, this would be you, because you would be a sentient being, whereas like this table is not. It's the ability to feel pain. When is there the actual ability to feel pain? And maybe use that as a marker or kind of a benchmark, so to speak, to determine the personhood of the fetus. So if the fetus cannot feel pain, then there's not really any loss due to abortion. It's not like you hurt the fetus, so to speak. Scott Ray said something that was really interesting about this. I thought it was pretty helpful. He said, this confuses the experience of harm with the reality of harm. He said, those are not the same thing. It confuses the experience of harm with the reality of harm. Here's an example that he gave. He said, I want you to imagine a paralyzed man whose leg gets amputated, you know, and even against his will, you could put in. Well, it's not like he experiences pain, but you could still say that the person experiences harm. I think a better example that we might could use is maybe a little bit more on point. I don't know how many of you have kept up with the news, but there was a man that was put in prison. And the reason that he was put in prison is because he had impregnated a woman that was in a comatose state. I don't know how many of you have kept up with the news. Well, if you can think of that example, you have a woman that's lying in a bed. It's not like she's able to give her consent to a sexual act. In fact, we know she can't. But he has sex with her. It impregnates her. She ends up delivering the baby, but it was because of DNA that they were able to find out that it was a guy that was working in the business that was the father of the child. He rightly gets arrested. But if we're looking at this, and I'm just trying to make a different point, right? Because if you're looking at personhood and you say, well, personhood begins with whether or not you have the ability to feel pain, I think that we maybe are making a little bit of a mistake here. And I hope the example that I just brought up helps make that point. And the point, going back to Scott Ray, is it confuses the experience of harm. She didn't experience it. She's in a comatose state with the reality of harm, which certainly would apply in that case. Here's another possibility. How about birth? Just birth. When do we confer all of these rights onto this child? How about birth? Some of you might remember in the last presidential cycle, one of the candidates said that there are no constitutional rights for, she said, a human person in the womb. And I was like, well, that's a bit of a mistake. Really what you mean is something that's biologically human in the womb, right? And it's basically what she was saying. And so birth, so to speak, became really the starting point for those rights to apply. But one of the things that I was talking about just a moment ago is still something we need to remember. There's no essential difference that exists between the fetus the moment before its birth and the moment right after its birth. There's no essential difference whatsoever, except for one, and it was the thing I pointed out before. It certainly has changed location, right? So maybe birth isn't the best place to start. The other reason that we know that birth isn't the best place to start is because of what we know about the life in the womb. We certainly know that the life in the womb is well beyond the ability to feel pain. And other factors, of course, would apply. So maybe birth isn't the best place to go. But in all of this conversation, I just want to point a few things, something out on the front end of this. There's some things that get said that to me are kind of obvious non-starters. These are things that aren't helping the conversation. In fact, what they do is they shut the conversation down. And that's not something that we need to do. And I also want to be clear here. You know, when you take a stand on an issue like this, it's not, as it were, to minimize the ability for you to minister to a person. We're trying to rightly think about an issue. We're trying to rightly think about an issue. And right thinking is a way of helping people. It's a way of helping people. But I also want to say something else. There's nothing that I wouldn't do to help a person that has made this decision. Nothing that I wouldn't do to help them out. But an obvious non-starter is something like what you saw happen in the clip, and it's why we showed it. Men cannot speak to issues about women. I mean, in essence, that's what's being said. Men cannot speak to issues about women. It's kind of a popular line. We're dealing with a woman's body. And so men are, by definition, ruled out of the conversation. It's her private right to choose. Sometimes maybe even going to the 14th Amendment to ground something like that. But what we're really dealing with here are arguments. That's what we're really dealing with here. And whether or not the arguments are good or bad. So men, in fact, can speak the truth about, for example, women's health issues. Men can, especially if they have the knowledge to do so. How about this? Preferably if they have the knowledge to do so. You could think of a man that is a gynecologist that could speak to women's health and reproductive issues. And certainly what we wouldn't want to say is, in virtue of him being a man, he doesn't need to speak to these things. That doesn't make any sense. Instead, what we need to get to is, what is the argument being made, and is it a good one? Here's why. Is because truth is not gender specific. Did you hear what I just said? Truth is not gender specific. Something's just true. And whether or not a man is saying it or whether or not a woman is saying it. But the other thing that kind of struck me as I was doing a lot of reading for this, isn't this exactly the kind of argument that a feminist would not want to make? Men can't really speak to this issue. Hold on. If you think about it, if you're saying that we shouldn't privilege people because of their gender, whatever the case may be, like pay, I don't care, whatever the case may be, if you want to say we shouldn't be privileging people because of their gender, I think I'm going to take this one point further and say we shouldn't privilege an argument simply because a woman makes it. Now, by all means, listen. She might be making a good one. But by all means, listen. He might be making a good one too. So we have to ask ourselves, what is really going on here? And shutting down the conversation because of gender is probably not the way to go. I'm suggesting it really isn't the way to go. Moreover, and more importantly, because what we're talking about is life itself. And we don't want to make a mistake regarding life. Here's a possible starter. So if that's a non-starter, what's a possible starter? Let me make this suggestion to you. When the issue is uncertain, I'll unpack this here in a little bit for you. But when the issue is uncertain, maybe a good guiding rule is err on the side of caution. When the issue is uncertain, maybe a good guiding rule is err on the side of caution. Here's why I'm saying that. And again, I want to hold off the legal discussion to later, okay? But Justice Blackmun, when he was rendering a decision in Roe v. Wade, one of the things that he said was, if philosophers and theologians and those in the medical community can't determine basically when this life really exists, you see it? There's the uncertainty, or at least there's the uncertainty that he brought up. We haven't come to a place where we all agree on this. Okay, so what would be a good guiding rule if we actually are in a place of uncertainty? And I would suggest to you a good guiding rule is you better err on the side of caution. Because what we're talking about here is a life that does have value, I think intrinsically, but also more than that. We're talking about a life. So if we're erring on the side of caution, guess what that would mean? That would mean that a lot of the decisions that we're making already answered for us. We're going to err, so to speak, on the side of life. So Scott Ray said this, hearing what sounds, it just helps to make the point about erring on the side of caution. He says, imagine that you're out in the woods and your friend, you're hunting, right? He says, and your friend goes into the woods and you hear a rustling in the woods and it sounds like a deer. By the way, you're deer hunting. Let me add that in, right? And you're deer hunting, right? Now, he would say a good rule of thumb is don't shoot into the woods. Why is that? It's because it's also the same place that your friend went into. Might be a deer, might not be. Might be your buddy. That's erring on the side of caution. That, I think, was Justice Blackmun's mistake in Roe v. Wade when he said, if philosophers, theologians, and physicians cannot determine when life begins, here was what he said. Let's assume it begins at birth. And I'm saying, wait, erring on the side of caution means you assume it begins at conception. That's erring on the side of caution. Even the question of viability, that's when the child can live outside of the womb. That's a less than perfect measure for personhood. By the way, viability is a moving target. It really is. And so that's one problem. What viability relates to is medical technology's ability to sustain life outside of the womb, and it has less to do with what is in the womb. It's just about what's sustaining what is there. You get the idea? Okay. So some of the most common arguments in favor of abortion rights. Let me just throw a couple of these things at you. One of those that you saw in the clip. A woman has the right to do whatever she wants with her body. A woman has the right to do whatever she wants with her body. So a person's right over her own body, though, when you think about it, it's not absolute. Your rights over your own body are not absolute, and we already know this. In most states, by the way, prostitution is illegal. It's your body. But in most states, prostitution is illegal. By the way, as is the use of a number of illicit drugs. Now, it's your body, But you don't have the right to put anything that you want into it. In fact, you might go to jail for that, right? So we already have this belief that yes, it is your body. It is, so to speak, not my body. But on the other hand, we already have laws that we know that are in place that show you this right is not absolute. Moreover, and I want to be very clear here, the fetus is not a part of the woman's body in the way that this is referring to it. It is not a part of the woman's, in the woman's body, yes, but a part of? That would be like saying that a person that is on life support is a part of the iron lung. And that's just not true. It's a life-sustaining measure. Certainly there is a dependence on the life on the womb, in the life in the womb for the mother. I don't think anybody is questioning that. But I think there are other things to remember about it. And it's that we're talking about a biologically complete entity in itself. And that's important to remember. It's genetically distinct. It has its own genetic code. Early in the pregnancy, it has its own heart and circulatory system. In many cases, it has a different gender than the mother. This is why Scott Ray, the ethicist, he said, this confuses the fetus being attached to the mother as being the same thing as the fetus being a part of her in a way that makes it lose its own identity. He said, to him, that just doesn't make any sense. That would almost be like saying if you had a tapeworm inside of you, then it's not really different from you. But everybody's going to look at it and go, no, there's a difference there. We're talking about something completely different. So here's the thing, historically, and I mean specifically historically here, when life and freedom, so you think about founding values that we treasure. When you talk about life and freedom, and you say, we're in a situation where those two values may not be able to coexist. Life is the one that always wins. Life is the one that wins. Freedom, by the way, assumes that there is a life to have it. It's more, so to speak, basic. It's more foundational. At least that's how the argument goes. So historically, when life and freedom are in conflict, life wins out. So if, and I'm just going to say if the fetus is a person, then very few freedoms exist that take precedent over the right to life. Very, very few. What about cases of rape? You'll hear this brought up. And fair enough. What about cases of rape? Part of what makes this difficult to discuss is because you're already talking about a horrific act, right? You're talking about something that is absolutely morally atrocious. This comprises, at least based on what the studies have indicated, if you're charitable, you might say 3% of the cases. Really, it's around 2% of the cases. And I also want to be clear here. Saying it's only 2% doesn't take the issue away. It being, so to speak, infrequent doesn't make it less of an issue, right? Paul Copan made this suggestion, though. He said, we need to be very careful how we think about this. Because one, we can get wrapped up in the emotional side of an issue. But maybe we shouldn't give the death penalty to a child for the sins of the father. Maybe we shouldn't give the death penalty to a child for the sins of the father. And here's the thing. If the fetus is a person, then it's difficult to see how taking another person's life is a morally acceptable practice in order to alleviate the mental distress of another person. And in fact, if you really think about it, why would birth all of a sudden be the stopping point for that? Why is that? What if you're talking about a child that creates severe mental distress for parents well after birth? You get the idea? And here's why I'm saying that. It's not to be insensitive. It's to make a point. And the point that I'm trying to make is that what you have from conception all the way to death is just the natural process of growth and development. There's no way to, so to speak, kind of parse this out in that development that isn't a totally arbitrary point. It's all a natural part of its development. So, Robertson McQuilkin, who's an ethicist, he said, good rule of thumb, It's better to suffer harm than to inflict it. It's better to suffer harm than to inflict it. Here's why I know that this issue is tough. I was sitting in a class. I shared this with somebody before we started tonight. This was years ago in my undergrad. There was a girl two aisles over from me in a class in sociology. This issue came up, and she brought up the fact that she had been raped. She had decided to abort the child. Part of the reason that she decided to abort the child, she said, is because she couldn't handle, so to speak, the physical reminder of that child and what had happened to her. And I can tell you on a totally emotional level, sitting there listening to her and going, I get it. I really do. I get it. On the other hand, even though we don't want to say that the morality of this issue depends on whether or not there are options for adoption, here's what we know. There really are options. And maybe we want to consider some of those options so that we can advocate for a life that, in this case, we're talking about a case of rape, didn't ask for it either. They didn't ask for it either. The question becomes, how can the church come alongside and help a person make the right decision? So here are a few thoughts going beyond that, and these are a few thoughts on the right to privacy. We know that it can't be an absolute right. So if your private belief, if you think about it, and nobody, by the way, nobody thinks that your right to privacy is absolute. Nobody that I've found. Here's an example. This is usually all I have to say. If your private beliefs allows that you own slaves, allows that you have 10 wives, discriminate against black people, mutilate Jews, the same persons that argue for the 14th Amendment and your right to privacy would probably say we need some legislation to step in because this is wrong. Nobody believes that this right is absolute. In fact, there's usually a pretty good guiding rule. You know, your rights end where my nose begins. Pretty good guiding rule. But I also want to say something else, at least with regard to some of these difficult topics, and it's this. While we recognize that there are difficult topics that people need to be loved through and helped through, we need to deal with what's really going on in the majority of the cases. Let's shine a spotlight on that. And in the majority of cases, it isn't like rape or incest or something else. A lot of times it's a matter of convenience. And that's what we really need to come to grips with. But on this matter of rights, and this is the way that I at least want to end for tonight, and then we'll get to your questions. The key question is whose rights? That's the key question. Whose rights? The right to life of the infant or the mother's lesser rights to something else? All the while, like I said, trying to be sensitive to the issue, sometimes we have to speak to the issue. And that's why I'm saying, as a church, what I would hope, what we would do is help somebody not just speak to the issue, but help somebody make the right decisions by doing life with them as they make the right decisions. Always more to the story, but I think that's a good place to stop. And I want to get to some of your questions. Are y'all ready for that? So I'm going to move this out of the way. And so while Melody's coming out to help, I want to recommend a couple of things for you. For those of you that like to read, there's a moral philosopher that I really like a lot. His name is Francis Beckwith. He's out actually up at Baylor University. Anybody, Baylor fans in here? There you go, Sick'em Bears. Francis Beckwith. There are two books that I would commend to you. One is his book called Defending Life. It's a fantastic read. And the other is a book called Politically Correct Death. And I would recommend you get that book as well. Hopefully that helps. I just want to turn to some questions here. So I'm going to take a seat. I'm going to get a drink while I go.
All right. We have already had a lot of amazing questions submitted on Menti. So again, if you have any questions that are either follow-ups or that you think of while we're doing the Q&A, you can head to menti.com, put in our code 68743, and submit those. You can also vote on the questions that have already been submitted, and I'll do my best to kind of stick to the most liked questions. Now, this is one of those topics that it touches a whole lot of other topics. So I'm going to try my best to focus on the questions that really kind of hit the heart of the issue. And we might be able to get to some of these other questions as well. Or later in the week. Exactly. Thank you. But thank you guys so much for submitting the questions that we've had so far. We have some really, really,
Really good ones. All right, so you ready to dive in?
Yes.
Well, let's hope
so. It's allergy season, everybody. Have y'all figured that out yet?
We'll see how much longer Jeremy's voice lasts. Okay. So what specific actions or steps should the church take in the face of this type of legislation?
What specific actions should the church take? Okay, here's the thing. Simply because something is legal doesn't mean it's moral, right? But here's the other thing. Simply because something is legal doesn't mean that somebody has to do it. So, one, I think the church needs to get out and not just speaking to the issue. This is why I was saying this before. Not just speaking to the issue, but helping women make the right decision. This is why I have partnered with the Human Coalition and met with women and let them know that there is a church, did this in North Carolina. We're happy doing this here. I've actually worked with Human Coalition here, gone down into the city and helped them out so that the women can hear there is help that's there, that will come alongside, will walk alongside, will provide the diapers and the wipes. And sometimes, folks, it's just the practical stuff. And a woman is completely overwhelmed by it because she does not see the help. And so for me, I'm like, let's remember what this issue really is. At its core, it is a biblical issue. It is not, at its core, a political issue. That's what it is, at its core. But that's also why just having talking points as a church is just not going to be good enough for me. It's just not. We should be the ones stepping up and saying, I'll put my money where my mouth is, if that's what it means to help this woman out. We've had families that have taken pregnant women that didn't have a home. They got booted out of their home, took those girls into their home so that they knew that there was a safe place for them to go. I'll give you an example. And this was an NC State student. And I remember sitting in the office of the Human Coalition in Raleigh. She came walking in. I was there for a completely different reason. She comes walking in. They're counseling her in another wing of the Human Coalition. And they came and grabbed me and they said, do you have just a few minutes? And I said, yes, I do. And so they took me in the room. I sat down with her. Here was the situation that she was dealing with. She said, I'm pregnant. My mom and dad have said you either get an abortion or we're cutting off your funding for your education and we're kicking you out of the house. What do you do to that? Because here I've got a 19-year-old girl that's a student, young lady, that is a student at NC State that doesn't know how she's going to have a nickel to her name because her mom and dad are looking to cut her off if she does not get an abortion. Here's what she wanted to know. I want to know that there's some options out there because she said, I don't want to kill this kid. I don't want to kill this kid. But what are the options that are out there? That's why I said the overwhelming majority of those cases are moms that are sitting there going, somebody help me. Help me. I don't want to do this. That's the part that needs to be. So when you look at the church, you say, what's the church's response? I think the church's response is primarily a practical one. It's like that. That somebody could come to the church and find the help that they need to make them, or to help them make the right decision. That's it. I think that is putting faith in your convictions to your feet. And I think that's a great place to start. Now, that being said, you do have the other side of it. Again, some of which I want to hold off for our discussion on Roe v. Wade, because I think you're going to enjoy it. Should we be, for example, meeting with legislators representing what we think and why we think it? I think the answer is absolutely. Of course we should. Because what we're talking about here, and again, skip the issue of personhood. We are talking about something that is human biologically and living, and nobody's questioning that. So for me, I just go to the parts we're not even questioning and say, what's the safest way to go to respect what we know? And so of course we need to have a voice. I mean, they're supposed to represent us anyway as well, right? So there's the practical answer. And then, of course, there's the get out there. Talk to your representatives. Let them know what you're thinking. Let them know why you're thinking it. We need to have people that are going to stand in the room with the people that were shown on the clip and say, there's another way of looking at this. And it's important that we consider it. Those are at least two suggestions that just kind of come off the top of my head.
Very helpful. Thank you.
All right. Are you ready for a big one?
No. Yeah, okay. Let's see.
All right. So in vitro fertilization leaves dozens or more fertilized eggs that are destroyed. How are we to treat this given our statement that life begins at conception?
Right. So a little bit of a different topic than what I was dealing with tonight. And in fact, I was telling Melody beforehand, I said, I'm trying to focus our conversation really on the abortion discussion, you know, because this is a topic on its own. I mean, it really is a topic on its own. So let me just say that.
I guess if you could hone in on, you know, where is conception as far as the life discussion?
Well, I mean, if you think about it, you don't have a biologically complete organism until the sperm and the egg unite. Until you have a conceptus, right? You don't have that. You have a sperm and you have an egg, right? That's what you've got. That being said, and again, I go back to a rule that kind of guides me in this. And President Bush, if you remember, he had a decision that was made, and you can read his book, Decision Points. He talks about the decision that was made regarding some of these issues. But one of the things that I would invite you to keep in mind is given the gravity, hear what I'm saying, given the gravity of what we're talking about, and given the gravity of what is at stake if we're making a mistake, I always just say, err on the side of caution. It's a good guiding rule. It also helps us avoid some of the weeds, so to speak. Not that it's unimportant, but it helps focus us in on how it is that we're going to make a decision pertaining to even issues like this, in vitro fertilization.
So another question says, what do you say to a Christian Democrat that adheres to the party philosophy that abortion is a woman's right?
I would probably say what I just said. No, I mean, in all seriousness, I do get where people are coming from. I do. I was trying to take what are considered some of the most prominent arguments, and I'm trying to take them very seriously because people really do believe these things. So I try to take them seriously. You know, that being said, you know, if you say, well, and by the way, there are Republicans also that would make some concessions, and there are probably even people in this room that I think would make certain concessions where you're going to maybe abort a pregnancy and you're going to do it medically. It's not like a spontaneous abortion. We're talking about you make a medical choice. I've had friends that have been put in situations where they had to make, and they love the Lord, by the way, and they had to make a medical decision that ultimately resulted in the termination of the life of the child. Okay. I say all of that to point something out. I don't think that this is a Republican issue. I don't think this is a Democrat issue. I think it's an issue. It's an issue. So what would I say? I just want to know where they're coming from. Just where are you coming from? Which of the arguments are you, so to speak, going from? Are you going from a woman has a right to privacy? Fair enough, because a woman does have a right to privacy. But again, not every right is absolute. And so we may want to look at it and say, is this one of those absolute rights? And if we're talking about something that's biologically complete, a biological human, maybe you want to say, actually, you don't have a right to terminate that. And without repeating everything that I was saying before, you have, you already have some of the things that I'm thinking about already, right? It's biologically complete in and of itself, and those kinds of things. It's not just her. Does that make sense? It's in her. It's not the same thing as her. So it just depends on the argument that's made.
I think that's an important distinction to point out. All right. There's a lot of good questions. So if the church does not support abortion, should the church support adoption in a much greater way than we do today? And should the church put a large public emphasis on child support in years 2 through 18?
Well, like I said, if you're going to describe yourself as pro-life, then you got to be pro-life. And life doesn't stop at birth, right? It doesn't stop at birth. So advocacy extends all the way through, as far as I'm concerned. If you want somebody that I think writes really well on this, let me encourage you to read Russell Moore. He's the head of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. He and his wife have been adoption advocates for years. I think that the stuff he writes on adoption is important and it's worth your time. But again, that's why I'm saying, look, if you want to be pro-life, you'd be pro-life. I think what a lot of people are for is pro-birth, and that's not necessarily the same thing. All right, got the baby born, and we're out. I just think there's a better way to go. So yeah, I think the church should be in practical ways on the front lines of advocating for life in very practical and pragmatic, by the way, and in theological ways. This kid is an end in itself and deserved this advocacy and this love, even if it's not optimal circumstances.
Okay, there's several questions that deal with contraception, and this was a really big debate at seminary that we got really heated in, as whether or not contraception was moral or not, and what types were and which types were not, and all of that. So can you please talk briefly as possible?
Okay.
There's your challenge for you.
To the moral difference.
Yeah, you have 2 minutes.
Okay.
To the moral difference between contraception and abortion, is there one? And things like the day after pill, are those acceptable or not acceptable? Are those like abortion, you know?
Yeah, I'm with you. All right, so when you think of the day after pill, it's usually regarded as an abortifacient, right? So let's put that out there first. But as far as the issue of contraception is concerned, you know that the churches don't agree, which is why it was a hot topic at seminary. Just saying. Some of this, so like if you look at a standard Catholic view, and some of this is because they're informed largely by St. Augustine. And, you know, St. Augustine, you know, had this idea that, you know, when it came to sexual intercourse between a husband and a wife, if you weren't having sexual intercourse with at least the idea of procreation in mind, then what you were doing was you were satisfying an ungodly lust. Now, just so you know, I'm going to be doing a series of sermons on the 7 deadly sins starting next week. There will be one on lust. Do you know that Scripture makes a distinction between ungodly and godly lust? There is a godly lust. So here's basically what I'm saying. I think Augustine was wrong. I'll just throw that out there. But the same church that would say, and I'm talking about the Catholic Church, the same church that would say you shouldn't, for example, be using condoms, and you think of all the flack that they were getting because of like the AIDS epidemic in Africa, and you're saying, man, there's so many ways that you could be advocating for these people with basically, you know, by informing them of this, but there was this theological sort of hiccup that was getting in the way. Nevertheless, what I find is that most Catholics, and even a number of Catholic ethicists that I read, have no problem with what's called the rhythm method. And it's basically the idea of you just kind of chart the woman's natural cycle, and then you plan to not have sexual intercourse in those times where she's going to be the most fertile. And I'm like, well, it kind of seems the same to me, right? At least if nothing else, in effect. So this gets into sexual ethics, right? But here's the idea. At the end of the day, I think that there's more going on with a husband and wife, even though, as God says, be fruitful and multiply, I think there's a whole lot more to sex than just being fruitful and multiplying. I'm saying that as a guy that has 4 children. There's a lot more to it. There's also more going on in a woman's body. Sometimes a woman is on birth control for purely biological reasons. It has nothing to do with whether or not she's open to the idea of having a child. It's because she needs it, regulates her system or things like that. You get the idea. So while it's complex, I don't know if I've even answered the question. That's just kind of where I go in my head with it. No, I don't see anything as far as contraception. I don't see like Scripture, you know, thou shalt not. I'm looking for the command. I don't see it there. It's just not there. That being said, there is something on the flip side. There is something on the flip side that I would say is a word of caution. When a person is going down the road because they see the road of conception, of contraception and stuff like that, because they see the child as an invasion on their life, then there's a deeper issue there to me. But you need to deal with that on a different level. The issue of contraception at that is, I think, just a symptom of something that's deeper that's deeper going on.
So we didn't even get to really even dive into some of the other legislation on the flip side of it with the heartbeat bill and such. So maybe you can briefly speak to some of that with this question. The question is, someone I know believes that life starts with a heartbeat. How do I refute that?
That life begins with a heartbeat? Okay. Well, that is one of the views that gets brought up. Why not say that life begins with life begins with a heartbeat? Well, one, there's some things to figure out. When do you usually find out that you're pregnant? By the way, it's not the night that you conceive, right? There's a lapse in time, you know. So give or take a month-ish, I mean, ish, give or take. Sometimes a little bit later, but you know, give or take a month. The reason that the heartbeat, and I just want to get back to the heart of the matter. No, I just did that, and it's the heartbeat point, right? Why would I not go the way of the heartbeat? And this is why, is because if that life has intrinsic value to it, then everything else that we're talking about here is talking around the issue. Everything else that we're talking about here talks around the issue. That would be, once again, an arbitrary starting point. It would be an arbitrary starting point on putting some value on that life, when in fact what we're talking about is this is the way that the child naturally develops in the womb. Does that make sense? So for me, I'm trying to avoid those arbitrary development points and to say, no, we're really talking about something on a different level here. If the child has intrinsic value, if it's an end in itself, then I think even a heartbeat would be an arbitrary starting point, because it's only one step from, well, it's only one step in the natural progression of what that life already is. Just like later, the child is born and you get a little bit of age on it and the child is talking, right? The child wasn't talking before, but that's a new development. It is. It's a new development in the natural progression of the life of the child, just like all of them are.
So you touched on several things regarding the medical reason for an abortion. So this question says, what about medical reason for abortion, i.e. the mother will die if she continues to carry? Is it worse to abort or worse to allow the mother to die for the sake of having the baby?
Okay, so let me give you an example. You know, I want you to think of a mom that is, you know, a mother that's pregnant, and she finds that she has cancer. And as a result of having cancer, they have a choice that they have to make. There are some medications that she can take, but the medications would bring about the end of the life. And so what do you do? That's a genuinely difficult situation. Here's the thing. The mother's life is intrinsically valuable, just like the child's life is intrinsically valuable. You don't become less intrinsically valuable because you're born or even 50 years old. Okay? You're just intrinsically valuable. This is the thing. When you say that you're created in the image of God and that your value is grounded in that, then what you can't say is, and once I hit 60, my value goes way down. All right, you know, I'm 43. Well, my value has depleted. No, it hasn't. It is exactly what it has always been, right? So the mother is intrinsically valuable. The child is also intrinsically valuable. You know, as a rule, this is where in ethics they'll say, you know, so long as the treatment isn't the means, so to speak. And when you think of this one couple that I have in mind, the treatment was the means of the eradication of cancer. That's what it was. The second effect of it was going to bring about the end of the life of the child. Now, in this case, you need to understand what they were really trying to do is something that we would view as a good. I just want you to hear the case, all right? They were trying to do something that was a good, namely to advocate for the life of a mom, which is a good thing. It's a good thing. Now, there are also some other questions that medically would come up. You know, will the child, for example, get to a place where it is viable in its development, meaning be able to exist without depending on the mom for sustenance, right? Those are questions. And sometimes you get answers to these questions. It's like the child won't make it anyway. Sometimes that answers things for you. So here's what I'm not trying to say. I'm not trying to say that there aren't genuinely difficult situations that people get put in. I'm not saying that. Because I can tell you, in this case, you know, I have good Catholic friends that might disagree with the choice that that couple made. I have good Catholic friends that would disagree with them. Both of them love Jesus, by the way. But here's what a friend of mine who is an ethicist, that is also Roman Catholic, would say. You don't put a life in danger that isn't in danger. If the mom's life is what is in danger and not the child, you don't endanger the child to save the mom. I can tell you he would say it because he's said it to me. So it gives you the decision that he would make. In this case, ensure viability and so forth, gets a place of viability. And at that point, you don't endanger the child for the well-being of the mom. But there is no consensus on this even among Christian ethicists, not in cases like this. I'd love to tell you that there is. There isn't. There isn't. I gave this example last week. We're sort of over on time. Did you know that, Melody?
Here's just so fascinating.
Yeah. Here's the thing. And this is what I said. Here's where we get trapped, is sometimes because there are multiple things that we value and we can't have all of it. We can't. You know, Wendy and I had to have some of these conversations when she got pregnant, and she's pregnant with Avery, and we're having to think through some of the what ifs, right? What does it mean for me as her husband to advocate for her if it doesn't mean to do everything I can to sustain her life? What does it mean? But then I sit there and I go, I'm also a dad. What does it mean as a dad if I'm not advocating for the life of my kid? And there are those unfortunate, albeit rare, but unfortunate circumstances where people have some things to figure out. I think it's also important to remind us, though, one last time, that is not the majority of what people are dealing with. The majority of abortions are really for matters of convenience. They are. So while trying to be sensitive to women that feel like they're stuck and pushing you to say you advocate for life, the majority really are for convenience. And I just don't see that as a morally overriding reason for the life in the womb. I'm just not there. Is that a good place to end since we're already over?
Are you guys ready to go home? No. I would just like to point out that we're not over time because of me. It's because he likes to talk.
I'm answering hard questions, people.
Just saying.
On the last one, she was like, in 4 words or less. Come on.
I'm trying to keep them concise up here. I'm trying.
I understand.
All right, so we're going to wrap it up. We do have a few more questions that are really good questions that we will be tackling on social media this week. Please go to Instagram or Facebook, not Twitter, to see those questions answered. We'll try to get them up in the first half of the week for you. Again, if you want to support what we're doing here, we'd love to have you do that at that very attractive little box over there or online, help keep the coffee flowing. But thank you all for being here for this extremely sensitive and extremely important topic. And again, I just want to close by reminding women out there who have been touched by this subject in their life that we have that Bible study starting soon. And can we get the email address up on the screen? So if you want to reach out to be a part of that Bible study, to be ministered to and help you work through what has happened, please just email restoredhearts@outlook.com. But thank you for coming, and we look forward to seeing you next week where we'll tackle more of the truth.
Indeed. Thank you for being here. I hope you have a great week.
We hope you have enjoyed the podcast. For more information about Veritas, visit us at www.veritaswbc.com.